Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God, and we're going to be talking specifically about eldership and clergy and how the church works, the mechanics of the church, and why is the mechanics of the church important? Because throughout history, there have been two ways that people take care of the needy of their society. You could actually say there are three, but there are two systems by which you take care of the needy of society. One way in which to take care of the needy of society really isn't called a system. It's just like if you see somebody in need, you help them out. You know, you find an old lady with a flat tire on the side of the road, you help her change a tire. If you find a guy in the ditch, you may help the guy in the ditch. You could be the kind of good Samaritan. And you can hope that somebody will be the good Samaritan for you if you end up in the ditch. And that certainly is a way to go through life, except for the fact that that's not a system. That's not a way. That's just kind of haphazardly. And you know you're going to miss people. You know there are going to be people in need and you're going to miss them. You help them out now and then they haven't completely recovered. And, you know, it's like helping a guy who's fallen, get up, and then you let him go, and he goes around the corner, and he falls again, and nobody's there, and he dies. So, it's not very efficient. So, throughout history, we have created ways in which to help the needy of society. And one way is what we would call today government. And we would say, well, you know, government, you give the power of government to take a little bit from everybody or a little bit from the rich or a little bit from whoever they think it's good to take from. And then they will have funds to help everybody else out. And that's what socialism is. That's what communism is. Social democracies, they all kind of operate that way. You know, you take from one class of citizen to give to another. But you have to give power to somebody to decide what to take and what to give in those systems. So that's the system, just kind of breaking it down. Now, it will vary from culture to culture and people to people. I mean, Sweden and Norway, they have some socialism there. They're not really socialist economies. They're a market economy. But they have a lot of socialist programs. And they don't have those programs without some problems. But one of the things that those programs allows is that everybody says, well, you go to the government. If you have a need, if you're homeless, whatever, go to the government. You know, and I actually saw where somebody did a social experiment where they had a young boy, and it was in Norway, and he was on a street corner at a bus stop, and he had no coat, and he was clearly very cold. And people, you know, there was like a young girl there, Norwegian girl. And I mean, she was mature, maybe in her 20s, early 20s. And she immediately took off her coat. I mean, you can see everybody's breath. It was cold. It's Norway. And put her coat around the guy. And other people would come to their aid and everything. Of the boy. But the boy wasn't of the age to go and apply for a free coat from everybody else. But the spirit is there to help that boy out. But it's not being practiced all the time because the way they help people out is they go to the government. And of course, if you go back to Jesus Christ and even before Jesus Christ with men like John the Baptist, and they're asking him how the kingdom works, he says, if you have no coat and your neighbor has two, your neighbor should share what he has with you so that you have a coat. Now, obviously, it's kind of like, you know, turn the other cheek thing. He doesn't mean everybody, you know, some guy who constantly, you know, he's got a job, he makes money, but he squanders it all on booze and prostitutes. And he finds himself out in the cold. Are you supposed to take your best coat and give to him so that he won't get cold? You get pneumonia. He doesn't get cold. Then he gets his next paycheck and he squanders it all on booze and prostitutes. And he's lost the coat when he was drunk. And so now he comes to you and he wants another coat. And you just went out and bought yourself a coat. And now you're supposed to give him your coat. Well, no. I mean, that's the whole thing about if you have something to spare, you share it with those that don't have enough. But you have to use some discretion in that process. Otherwise, your affluence and your charity is going to weaken this guy and weaken the poor. And that, of course, was the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. The point is, two systems. One system forces you to buy your neighbor the coat through the use of courts and through the use of laws. They force you to contribute to the government, and the government decides who gets a coat. The other system, these are the two different systems, is that you pick men that you think are wise, intelligent, diligent, charitable, have a good sense of justice and moral fair play, dedicated to the idea of community and helping other people, and you fund them. You have some extra money and you give him a share of it. And you get together with some other people and everybody gives him a share, and now he goes out full time trying to help people that are in need. And if you see somebody in need, you can give him obviously you help the guy up out of the ditch, but you say, oh, this guy needs, you know, he's going to need some meals and he's going to need to get better. You know, he's got an injury. I know a guy got an injury up in a nearby town, and he was living in his car because he couldn't get a job because of his injury and all this stuff, and he wanted help. And we tried to help him. But he needed some help, like he needed to, you know, he had family. You know, why does it say pure religion is visiting the widows and orphans? Because the widows and orphans don't have family. Their family's broken down somehow. So that means that they can't go to their family. But if you got somebody who's, where was that boy's parents who had no coat? You know, that's one of the things that I would ask. So why don't you have a coat? Where's your coat? Did you lose your coat? Did your parents not give you a coat? Are you that poor that you can't afford a coat? Now, some people just immediately took off their coat and put it on him because they could see he was cold. They themselves now were without a coat, and it was very cold for them, but they were taking it, suffering the cold for him. Now, they weren't necessarily giving him that coat so that he could go away and disappear. They need to ask him some questions like, how far do you have to go? Am I going to get my coat back? Do you have another coat somewhere else that we could find? Maybe we go to the store and pick you up a coat. Maybe we can call your parents. I mean, we had five little kids camping down at the lake below our house one time. I mean, we're out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, there were no houses around us at all. And these kids were camping out. I mean, they were young kids. I mean, like 9, 10 years old. And they didn't even have a bike for everybody. They had evidently pedaled all the way from another valley, which is like 20, 25 miles away, and ended up here. And they were collecting bottles and cans along the road and turning them at the store to get food. And they were gathering all the junk and garbage around their little campsite down by the lake. And a cold front came in. This was late in the summer. And a cold front came in the mountains. And it was cold outside and windy. And it rained a bit. And they ended up at our house asking for help. And we brought them all in. I mean, it was just storming outside. We brought them all in. And we said, so what's the deal? And they're down camping. And I said, so where's your parents? Well, do they know where you are? Yeah, they don't care. And like, what? You know, these little kids camping down, you know, 20, 30 miles away from home, and their parents don't even care. And I don't even know what they're doing all for food. They couldn't be collecting that many pop cans to get food. But anyway, we fed them. We got a hold of their parents. We gave them the phone so they'd call their parents. We thought their parents would just rush over and pick them up right away. Their parents said they'll come and get them tomorrow. They weren't going to come out and get them that night. Wow, we were just shocked. And we got extra blankets and sleeping bags. We were pretty prepared out here. And we laid them out on the floor near the fire, and they all slept there. And we made a big breakfast and fed them all pancakes, I think it was, and eggs and stuff. And their parents didn't show up till almost 11 o'clock. And I had drove down to get what stuff they had. But, I mean, we didn't even want the stuff that they were sleeping in our living room. So that's why we got all the other blankets. We had it all loaded up in our truck. But when their parents came at 11 o'clock the next day, it was pretty late anyway, the kids all just ran out and loaded up in their car and drove away. They never said boo to us. They never said anything to us. They just disappeared. And, I mean, the kids were kind of thankful and everything, but when their parents showed up, they ran out, got in the car, and they just went away, and we never ever saw them again. Now, those kids are out there somewhere. Someday I may run into them, and they'll identify themselves. Of course, they're all grown-up people now. But, you know, that's just astounding that we've gotten to a society where people are just that callous and irresponsible. But they are. And how many people, it used to be, if you had a need, you went to church. Now, if you go to church, pastors, I know all kinds of pastors, they have a list of telephone numbers that you can call, all government services. That if you have a need, they will help you by getting you in touch with men who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority one over the other. Because they're not going to feed you, clothe you, house you. They're not going to help you, train you up, get you a job. They're not going to make you a productive member of society. They're just going to tickle your ears on Sunday. Now, to be honest, many of these churches do have charitable outreaches. But in almost every church, unless it may be some Amish churches and Mennonites, almost every church I know of, 80 to 90 or more percent of the charity for the widows, orphans, and needy of society is provided not by the church, but by the government. But that's what religion used to be, helping out one another, helping others. It is the rightly dividing the bread from house to house. They had free bread in Rome. They had social welfare in Rome. And it was given out to all the citizens. On a weekly basis, free bread, on a weekly basis. And they gave it out to Judeans. Roman charity was immense, but now I call it charity. It's not really charity, it's welfare. Charity, for it to be charity, it would have to be the people of Rome donated money to the government, and then the government went out and provided free bread for the needy of their society. And at one time, that's the way Rome did it. But by this time, that's not the way Rome was doing it. As a matter of fact, 150 years before, Rome had stopped doing it and started, I shouldn't say stop, but pretty much stop. They had become accustomed to feeding at the expense of others and had instituted the rule of force to take care of the needy of their society. Both systems were called religion. Because that's what religion was. It was what you did to take care of the needy of your society. So Christ comes along, John the Baptist comes along, and says you're supposed to do it by free will offerings and charity. And Rome and the Pharisees were doing it by another thing. And you read articles on Corbin, on Corvey systems. All these things explain how these systems work. And the Corbin of the Pharisees was making the word of God to none effect, but the Corbin of Christ was your salvation. And lots of people followed Christ, but when Christ said, no, you're going to have to do it this way. You have to eat of my blood and drink of my flesh. Or drink of my blood and eat of my flesh. That's a metaphor. for you have to provide for one another the way I'm saying. We see that with the blind man. I just talked about this morning. We see that with a blind man who is professing Christ, and he's told that you can't do that. And so they went to ask his parents, and the parents were asked if they confessed Christ, and they said no, because they feared being put out of the synagogue. And if they were put out of the synagogue, they were put out of the social welfare system of Judea, because that's how they administered that system, was through the synagogues. Synagogues were congregations of 10 men. And then those 10 men would be connected to with each other in a synagogue or in groups all the way up to the temple, and all the money was put to the temple, and the temple sent funds back to the people. But by that time in history, the Molokai and Gabai ministers were out there collecting the tithe by pacing off fields of grain and by counting your sheep and counting the branches on your cumin plants, and they were taking their share. It was compulsory offering. You had to pay it. It was called a tax, not a tithe so much. But Christ says, no, we got to go back the other way, because you can't get your rights back unless you go back the other way. So anyway, this is what the early church was doing. And they had this mention of elders in the early church. And so what are the elders of the early church? How does that work? What are their duties in the church? Well, this was the big thing that we talked about this morning extensively, and we're going to create a whole series. Elders were old men who were heads of families. They were elder in a family. They were the oldest in a family. So it would be grandpa, his married sons and unmarried daughters, and his sons' sons. Who were married and their unmarried daughters. All that's one family. And when the son goes to get married, he doesn't go to the state. He goes to his father and asks permission to get married, because it's important that the father agree, because that woman is going to become a part of grandpa's family. And grandpa and all the uncles and everybody, you know, you wanted to get into a good family, a good strong family where everybody's working. There aren't a lot of alcoholics and lazy people. And because if something happens to your husband, you're going to depend upon that family to take care of your needs. Now, if they're really, the family completely breaks down, which can happen during wars and disease and famines, fires, like I mentioned this morning, the Paradise Fire in California. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of people die. There's 9 people, I think, have died, but it was a whole family wiped out. There could have been a survivor of that family. Who's going to take care of that if the whole family but one is wiped out? Well, that's an orphan. So society is going to have to take care of that person. And the reality is that so many people were damaged in that community, they need a network that reaches way beyond. And I just put up a page called Clergy that was because people confused what is clergy. A lot of people think, oh, we don't need a clergy anymore, we just need to come together and love one another. But it's all sitting in the chair kind of love. It's not the love of the early church. It's a different kind of love. But you know, clergy is defined as the body of all people ordained for religious duties. That's what it's, a body. It's like a corpus, a corporation, you know. And the early ministers, they owned all things common. Everybody didn't own all things common. It was just the ministers owned all things common, because that's what the Levites did before them. They owned all things common. But Christ was coming to return every man to his possessions, every man to his family. Well, if you own all your stuff, your possessions have been returned to you, and your family has been returned to you, and you're not collateral for the debt of your ministers, which is always astounding when I see churches borrowing money to build the big building because the building's important. No. You do not want to borrow money. Of course, you can't hardly do that unless you incorporate or apply for 501c3 status under the authority of the IRS or any of these other things, which is really not a good thing. And the law doesn't even require that you do those things. But if you want to borrow money, they're going to require it. But why in the world would you be borrowing money to build a building to take care of the needy of your society? Because, and how does that take care of the needy of society? I mean, it's not housing anybody. As a matter of fact, it sits empty most of the week. It's just a place to go where everybody can get this good feeling that they're in the church. And that's why a lot of people are getting out of that. They're going to home churches. But you show me where there's a network of home churches that if they heard about the fire in paradise, that they could, they would have ministers that they could give money to right now and supplies to right now and get in a truck and drive and know who to give money and aid to in paradise. That's a town in California that just burned up. People are in the news. They know that just burned up. I mean, we just had a big fire in the nearby town. Nearby town's about 44 miles away for us. We're out, like I say, in the middle of nowhere. But I built a restaurant there with my brother years and years ago. We were the contractors who built the restaurant. It just burned down. They just had a fire. It was coming. They weren't doing the maintenance on the ducts over the stove and stuff like that. And it was probably a grease fire. That's my guess. It was a grease fire. Could have been a motor, fan motor or something like that. But anyway, it burned. It didn't burn to a pile of ashes, but I've heard that it's a total loss. And it's a shame because it's the only restaurant in that town. It's not a big town, 300 people. So that's our nearby town. And as a matter of fact, in our county, I think that's the only incorporated town in the whole county. So, like I said, we're out kind of in the middle of nowhere. But anyway, clergy is this body, a corpus of people ordained for religious duties, especially in the Christian church. What are religious duties? Well, the religious duties of the early church was to feed my sheep. We see them handing out bread and fishes. We see them taking care of people when there's dearths, you know, which are economic depressions. We see Paul and Barnabas moving aid from one city to another country to help them out, and writing ahead that you should take up your collection before we get there so we don't have to waste a lot of time to do that because we're going to take up those funds and get them where we need to go. We see Galatia helping out the people in Corinth. Corinth was way wealthier than the people in Galatia. Why in the world do they have to send aid? Because the people in Corinth were shifting over to this other system. We're talking about the Christian people in Corinth. Everybody didn't want to go over to that system. Although we do see Paul talking to the treasurer of Corinth, explaining how the kingdom works. We have the apology of Justin the Martyr, explaining how the kingdom worked to, you know, Antonius Pius, who's the emperor of Rome. So we have those documents, and we see them saying those that had shared with those that did not have enough. And why are they telling that to the emperor? Because there was a complaint because Christians were not signing up for the welfare systems offered by Rome, offered by Ephesus. As a matter of fact, they had set up their own system of banking. It really wasn't called banking. As a matter of fact, the system is still around today. I talked about it a little briefly this morning. But it worked a lot like a credit union. It is those seven men. And we have an article explaining those seven men that, you know, the daily administration in Greece is being neglected. And so they said, we need to do something. Well, they said, it's not right that we, the clergy, the apostles, leave what we're doing, rightly dividing the bread from house to house, and wait on tables. What tables? What do you mean tables? Well, that same word is translated bank. And what that was is they would pick seven men who would be in charge of finances so that they could develop a way in which to move large sums of funds, money, from one part of the world to another part of the world to help out the needy in another part of the world. So that's what they were doing, is starting that. The amazing thing when I first began to study that and try to figure out why seven men, because that's not how the church was organized. Church is organized in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, as Christ commanded. You know, home churches, 10 families got together, and that was a congregation. And they picked a minister, and that minister got together with 9 other ministers, and that's a congregation of ministers. And then they pick a minister, and he gets together with 9 other ministers like him, and that's the tens, hundreds, and thousands. And they took care of one another through that system. They knew when somebody was in trouble, they had a way of, you know, who was going to take the funds to Paul or to Barnabas to take to this other place. Well, how did they move those funds around if they needed more or more was collected after Paul and Barnabas left? Well, this is the job of those 7. And they had the same system in the Old Testament. See, if you don't study history, you don't know really what's going on. Now, I said it's like a bank. It is like a bank, but it's not a bank. As a matter of fact, you can have the same institution today. They're around everywhere. But in many countries, they're not allowed to call themselves a bank. If you want to know more about it, join the network and we'll explain how that works. But the reason for its existence is to provide pure religion. In other words, the care for the needy of your society. I mean, in your little congregation, you can help one another out. But what have you lived in paradise where, what was it? It's like thousands of homes have burned there. Well, all those people, that who's going to help each other out? I mean, they will help each other out, but they've been devastated financially, economically, emotionally. They're going to need aid from where the houses haven't been burned down. What if they had to flee there and they couldn't live there at all? What if there's a nuclear power plant and they had to flee? And like I've given that example many times, that there's a possibility of that happening still today. We have nuclear power plants all over. If they go Fukushima, you may not be able to stay in your community. It's not about your house burning down. Your house will still be there, but you can't live in it because it's all radioactive. So where do you go? Well, if you had a network all across the country, you could go there. And we've seen that where people have had been displaced and they were brought into other Christian communities and helped out. But the early church was very organized at this. And this is why Jesus said, commanded, didn't just say, commanded, that they sit down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. So you have these ministers. Now, the amazing thing is, which I also shared with other groups today, you know, somebody who's a well-known pastor, I won't say his name, but he's been under the delusion or the incorrect impression that when Israel went into bondage in Egypt, when they went under the authority of the Pharaoh, that they were just guests, that they weren't in the same bondage as all the other people of Egypt who had to pay 20% of everything they produced, 20% of their labor, belonged to the Pharaoh, belonged to the government of the Pharaoh. And that was called the bondage of Egypt. But Israel was in the bondage of Egypt from the beginning. They were not exempt. But that bondage was benevolent. But then after a while, it got a little oppressive and they put heavy burdens on them, which is what it explains in the Bible. But they were in bondage. When Moses brought them out, it was written very clearly in Deuteronomy 17, you would never do anything to return the people to the bondage of Egypt. What's the bondage of Egypt? You don't own your labor, you don't own your land, you don't own your children, you don't, you know, you're in bondage. Well, that's what every country is in. And why? Because they haven't been seeking the kingdom of God. How do you seek the kingdom of God? You gather together in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, and you take care of the needy in your society through faith, hope, and charity. It's a social insurance program. That's what religion is. But it's not really insurance, it's assurance. If you were, the Amish do this already. If all the Christian churches were doing what the Amish are doing, all the Christian churches would be exempt from Obamacare. And if all the Christian churches were exempt from Obamacare, there would be no Obamacare. Because there wouldn't be no need for Obamacare. And because they couldn't sell it to anybody. And so it wouldn't be a popular idea. But because the churches are not taking care of one another, are not feeding their sheep, are not providing the social welfare of their society, which they used to do, a lot of people are not going to church anymore. Because, you know, the music just doesn't cut it. The good feeling just doesn't cut it. Somebody has undermined their view of God. But the reason that that was able to take place is the people who go to church had already undermined the duties of the church, the duties of religion. Religion, like I said, just 200 years ago, 250 years ago, was defined as the pious performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. That's what religion was. In order to perform that duty, you had to be sacrificial and contributing to the church, not to build buildings, but to take care of the living, because the church is for the living. The kingdom of God is for the living. You have to remember, Jesus said, I'm going to take the kingdom away from them, the Pharisees, which he did, and he did it by the words of their own mouth, and I'm going to appoint it to his little flock to bear fruit, and he did. And they went out, and they were doing what the modern church doesn't do anymore. So if you go to our page on clergy, you'll see that, that's the job of the clergy. Somebody asked, there was an office of priest and an office of bishop mentioned and an office of deacon mentioned in the New Testament. In the King James, we see that phrase, office of deacon, office of bishop, office of priesthood. What were they doing? What was their duty? Again, it was the tens, hundreds, and thousands, and providing for the bread from house to house when there was a need. So that nobody had to go to the men who call themselves benefactors and swear their allegiance in order to get those benefits. To put their children up as collateral for debt in order to get those benefits. Now, this is what the early church knew. This is what the early church was doing, but the modern church doesn't do it anymore. And so they think, many of them think, that an elder is an office of the church when an elder is an office of the family. It's the eldest of a family. And they looked out amongst themselves. They found men they trusted who were elders, and they trusted them because they saw they had good families, which we see in Titus and Timothy. And they appointed them over the business of being deacons and bishops. Every bishop is a deacon. He's a minister to 10. That's what a deacon is, a minister to 10. And we have a whole webpage that explains why a deacon, I mean, this is the way it's been for centuries and centuries in all kinds of different cultures. And they had all kinds of work, diakonos and deacon and dean. These are all chiefs of 10, ministers of 10, servants of 10. And that was because this idea of organizing society in groups of 10 has been around since before Nimrod. Nimrod even used it. Genghis Khan used the groups of 10. But there are those that organize themselves from the bottom up, where the ministers do not exercise authority over the people. And then there are those who organize from the top down, where they tell you what group you're in, and it's all for the purpose of taxation. Now, the groups of 10 that Christ wanted you in were for the purposes of wise and efficient tithing. It wasn't necessarily 10%. You give to the minister according to the need and according to his service. He doesn't just automatically get it. And he gets it because he gets it according to the perfect law of liberty. And it's not liberty if you have to give it. I mean, no, you don't see any Levites arresting people for not tithing. That's just not the way it worked. As a matter of fact, they specifically say you give to them according to their service. And they call it a free will offering over and over again. But it's called a tithing, a gift of 10, because it's the gift that comes from the 10 elders of your congregation. They decide what to give the minister. But that minister had to have a particular status. And we show in numerous places where Christ required the same status of his ministers. It's one of the most unpopular ideas amongst the modern Protestant clergy. But the reality is it's there in black and white, so you can't deny it. Well, you can deny it. people do all the time, but it's there, and we explain it. And I got some great stories about when I was explaining it to ministers, how they became very nervous, and you could hear the ice in their tea glasses just shaking, because they really can't argue against it. They can complain, but they really can't argue against it. It just doesn't work out that way. So anyway, we're going to look at a few other things here in this whole process of understanding what the clergy is and what the laity is and what the elders are. Because if you're the head of a family, you're an elder. But we'll have to do that in a minute. First, we're going to take a little break here because they make me take little breaks. And then we'll return to Keys to the Kingdom. So, welcome back. So, we're talking about this eldership. So, eldership really is the responsibility of every male head of family within a congregation of people. Congregations were always called free assemblies. They weren't corporate groups. They just came together in free assemblies. When they left, they left. What they left their ministers that they trusted, they gave to them, and hopefully they used that in a wise way. If they didn't, they stopped giving to them and found ministers that would. Right now, the number of people that understand how the kingdom works, there's a lot of charitable people out there, but a lot of them don't understand how the kingdom works. And so how do you get that to them? Well, you can go out on the street corner and hand out brochures and leaflets, and you would come in contact with, 200, 300, maybe 500 people in a day if you're really busy. And most of them would not want to hear it. In this modern age, with 350 million people in America, with 7 billion people in the world, the only practical way to get this information out is in multimedia. And we can show you how lots of people all of a sudden go viral and they get well known. The right set of circumstances has to be in place, and they will get well known. So you need people who can be articulate, who can think on their feet, can explain every aspect of the kingdom. And so we're going to start putting together courses so that you can understand. And one of the first things that you need to understand, that the elders were heads of families. The best heads of families were picked to be the diaconus, ministers of 10. And those diaconuses got together and picked their diaconus, minister of 10, who we can also call an overseer, because they serve not just the 10 ministers that they have picked them, but the 100 families that those ministers also serve. So we have words like overseer. But these are not overseers. They're servants. They're not rulers. They only rule over what you freely give. And if they do a good job, you can give them more. If they don't do a good job, don't give them anything. That's what liberty is all about. It's a responsibility. You can't have your rights back unless you take back your responsibilities. And so, and the ministers have to learn how that works. And the elders have to learn how families work. So many families are broken up. Husbands and wives leave each other. You know, it used to be that if a wife left her husband, she was destitute. You know, she couldn't do anything else. If a husband left his wife and children, he was going to die an old man in a ditch somewhere. Family was your salvation. And other families gathering together in free assemblies was the only way in which you could be free. If you knew enough about history, you would know that that is the only alternative to liberty, is to find other people who care about your liberty, your rights, as much as you care about your own. And you have to do the same, because why would they have you if you don't care about their rights as much as you care about your own? So the what the elder is doing is gathering to not save himself, but to equally save others. That's a whole different modus of operandi, the spirit by which you gather. That is coming in the name of Christ. Anything other than that is not coming in the name of Christ, name of Yeshua, the name of God, because that's been the plan from the beginning, that you take care of one another by loving one another. So anyway, we're reading little excerpts from these other pages that talk about eldership that think that elders are an office of the church. And they say, I see and hear many elders-led churches call some pastors and some elders, and I believe that they are simply distinguishing between staff and paid elders and non-paid elders. Do you all see this? How should it be handled? Well, we don't have any pastors who are paid. We don't have any ministers who receive a salary. One reason is we don't have lots of donations. The other reason is we know that, you know, Paul made tents. Aquila and Priscilla were probably a part of the 120 that's been generally accepted that were in the upper room. So those were the early clergy, the early ministers. They're all making tents and selling those tents, sometimes giving those tents away at a low price in order to help the needy of their society. But they're in a business that is making money. I make tents occasionally. I don't have to do it all the time, but I spent last week making the floors for tents. A bunch of tents that ended up being set up in Aspen, Colorado. But yeah, I didn't do it for a wage. I didn't do it for a salary. I did it because somebody who's helped out the church a lot, who does make tents, needed help. And so I went and helped him. I'm sure he'll contribute back for the time and energy that I put into it. But I'm self-supporting. The other ministers, we work and support one another because we all own all things common. And so we're able to do the work that we do. And, you know, we're not in the world. We're not of the world. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. So our work is for Christ only. If you read the Free Church Report, it explains how that works. And it's in the laws. This is the thing. It just astounded me. Like I said, you know, half a century ago, I was studying in St. Joseph's College and asking them, why is this? Why is that? Nobody could give me answers because they didn't understand. And this is the problem. They don't understand how it works. And I was actually studying with a church that should know. Of course, they're not teaching the people because it might get out how it works. But the laws are on the side of those who follow the ways of Christ. Now, it won't always be that way. I'm sure they'll turn against us. But we have to step out on faith and actually do what Christ said. If you do what Christ said, your ministers will be separate from the world. The world says so. And of course, Jesus said, my kingdom's not of this world. And the judge washed his hands of the case because the judge knew what he was talking about. Most of you, when you read that, have no idea what he was talking about. And we explain this in many other recordings. But in this course, what we're going to be focused on is this role of elders. So no, elders are not paid. Ministers are not paid a salary either. They have a different function altogether, a function of faith. Now, they can eat, you know, ordained minister can eat of the altar. The licensed ministers really can't eat of the altar. They can pay expenses and, you know, if they're traveling, they can cover that and a per diem and everything. But we don't have much of that. An ordained minister, he doesn't have a personal estate. He's separate. His labor belongs to him because you can't serve two masters. And he is a servant of God. He's not a servant of the world. He's outside the jurisdiction of the world as far as his labor is concerned. And there's a lot more to it, but I'm not going to go into all the detail. But this is important because what you give to him can't be touched by the world according to the law. And they can't just arbitrarily change that law without incurring the wrath of God. And when hard times come, that's going to be critical. But you, right now, as individuals, have to start caring about others. That's why you have to sit down in the congregation. So go to preparingyou.com, go to hisholychurch.org, join the network, join the living network by becoming a part of a congregation. You'll probably be spread out, but be diligent in that congregation, not to save yourself, but to save others. And yeah, you can support this ministry, and we're going to try to get out into more and more media so that people can start to understand how this works. But we're trying to return you to your family. We want to return your rights to you, but we don't have possession of them, but we know you can't get your rights back until you take back your responsibilities. So you're a government of the people, for the people, and by the people that takes care of the needy of your society through faith, hope, and charity. That's a hard thing for people to accept and to understand, because they think the church is where you go to feel good about being saved, even though you're not doing the will of the Father, and get your daily bread from men who exercise authority. That's not what you're supposed to be doing. This one guy who puts on this course, he says the word pastor and elder are interchangeable, and they're not really. Pastor is a shepherd. The word we see is for pastor is also a minister. It's also a deacon. And because it's this, you know, that's the amazing thing, is they translate the same word in the Greek into a number of different ways. They shouldn't be doing that. It says, how do you handle non-scriptured positions, just meaning we don't really see them in the scriptures, like a children's minister? Do you have an elder who specializes in the children department? Christ was a children's minister. Suffer unto me the little children. We are all supposed to be serving the children. Most of the questions that he's coming up with doesn't really make any sense. It really, because of the fact that he has imagined that an elder is an office of the church, it's an office of the family. And it's the fathers of the family who should be teaching their children. That's why we're all for homeschooling, home health, home education of all sorts. But we also know that there are other things that you need to do out there. We have quite a variety of people who are skilled. One of the questions here is, do the elders select Sunday school curriculum? What? What are you talking about? Fathers. See, they don't understand. They have to find something to do because they're not rightly dividing the bread from house to house. I can guarantee you that would be enough work. They also think that they're spiritual leaders. Well, they might be leaders and they might be spiritual, but everybody is supposed to be led by the Holy Spirit. We're not supposed to teach every man, because every man knows by the Holy Spirit. I share with you what I know. You share with those you know with what you know. Each of us have the right to share what we have discovered, and we learn that way. That's what, you know, when you sit down in church, and you gather in a church, you should all be talking about what you've learned and your different skills and learning this. But people go to church to put on this prayer face and this prayer hat and this prayer feeling. Because they're going to church to get a feeling. I've had people time and time again tell me, you know, I go to that church because I like the music. I go to that church because it makes me feel so good. You know, I go to that church because they really are firm about the fact that I'm saved because I believe. I don't have to do anything. I can just sit there. And they love that. It's just not what the kingdom of God is all about. It's not the righteousness of God. It isn't the plan. It doesn't get you closer to the plan. It doesn't help you seek the kingdom. Where are the men who are the servants of servants of servants? It tells you, Christ says, there is a rank in the kingdom, in the ministers of the kingdom. He who is to be highest amongst you is to be servant of all. How do you do that? 10 men. Pick a minister who serves the 10 men. He picks with other 9 ministers. He picks a minister that serves those 10 men plus the 100 men by default. that they serve. So the highest amongst you is the servant of servants of servants of servants, not the rulers of rulers of rulers of rulers. This is what they're talking about in Timothy and Titus, that you're going to be picking men who have proven themselves, who are elders. They're not qualifications of an elder. An elder who has these qualifications is qualified to be a deacon, a minister. That, and if you don't think of it that way, it creates a continuous change of the way in which you see all of the church. It allows you to think that you go to church, that you go to church to get a feeling, to get, you know, the spiritual feeling, this release of endorphins and dopamine that makes you feel good. You go to church to do good and to create a network that can accomplish that good because you care about one another. All the troubles of the world today, all the troubles in all the countries, are because people think the government is supposed to solve the problem. They're supposed to solve the problem. And the church is a government, but it's a government of liberty. It's a government of choice. It's a government of empowerment, empowering each elder of each family to make choices and decisions about where he's going to congregate, who he's going to congregate with. Is he going to call in on his congregation calls or meet when he can? I mean, everybody didn't go to church meetings all the time. We see that right away, 150 AD. It said those who came shared with those who did not have enough. And deacons who came would take back home to the congregation they served that which they needed. So everybody didn't have to go to the meeting. That deacon would come back and he would share what he heard at the meeting, and he would share the extra bread that he needed to help out the people in his congregation. And all those deacons knew each other because they were meeting every week and discussing, you know, who needed what and who was having trouble with what. They were persecuted. Eventually there would be invasions. And they were leaders in giving. So, yeah, they had a spiritual leadership there. But each individual, and understanding that, we would like to start bringing people here for a week or 2 weeks at a time, maybe even longer, if they want to put in a little sweat equity in the effort. And we start teaching them how to be still and how to listen for the Holy Spirit. You know, they talk about women ministers. Why would you need women ministers when the heads of the families are men and all married to wives who have raised a good family? Wouldn't those wives be a part of his ministry? Wouldn't his daughters and sons be a part of his ministry? Absolutely. Some of my sons do counseling on a regular basis to other people, helping them out, helping them learn to read, helping them do all sorts of things. They have full-time jobs. They're not getting paid by me, but they're participating in these efforts. My daughters and daughter-in-law, some of them put a lot of work into helping people learn about homeschooling and do homeschooling. Some of them actually work in public schools. You know, my kids never went to school. They never were in a classroom until I had two of them were in a classroom, but their first experience in a classroom was teaching in the classroom. Actually, you could probably say three of them. First real experience in a classroom was teaching, but they were homeschooled. They didn't go to a regular school. They didn't have regular courses or classes or anything. But they're all successful at what they're doing. And yet we have people wanting to be ministers who their family is not so successful. It doesn't mean that, see, this is the thing, is that every elder is a minister to every other elder because we're all part of the ministry. If you think you can designate one individual to be a part of the ministry and then all that responsibility falls on him, you're going to burn him out. I think we have an article up on ministry burnout. Because they're not following the plan. They're not following what the early church was doing. They don't even know what the early church was doing. You know, here it says, here's another question that this guy comes up with. It's a whole website that talks about eldership, and we were kind of going through it for the first 2 hours. And I'm almost out of time here, but his question was, are the pastors required to give a tithe or give? Absolutely. But again, because there are 10 ministers who gather together in a congregation of ministers, and so whatever they give, that's a tithe. It's not 10%. It's what they give. And they're giving it to their minister. In some weeks, it might be a huge amount, but why is he getting that? He's getting that to help move those funds to where they can help other people in the network. Anyway, we're going to continue this program and study more about this and how the actual mechanics work. And we hope that you put it together so that you begin to understand. But we'll have to do it next week. Until then, peace on your house and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.